Hi, this is Steve Roost, and you're listening to Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Each week, we give you the best news, views, and interviews from the health technology world. From CEOs and founders to entrepreneurs and clinicians, the companies and people that are shaping the future face of healthcare. All on the world's number one talk health radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, Steve Roost. Each week we bring you the best news, views and interviews with the leaders, CEOs, founders and clinicians who are shaping the face of healthcare in the UK and beyond. As regular listeners will know, I am the CEO and co-founder of a business called PocDoc, which is using smartphones and digital diagnostic pathways to massively increase access to cardiovascular screening in the NHS, in pharmacies, and in workplaces. As ever, thank you to PocDoc for supporting the show. And if you want to find out any more information about PocDoc, please reach out to me directly or head to PocDoc.co, PocDoc.co. Thanks, as ever, to everybody joining us live on UK Health Radio, the UK's best health radio station. So it's not just me on this station, believe it or not. There are a huge number of other amazing presenters with amazing shows. And the team at UK Health Radio work tirelessly to bring you fantastic content. So please do show your appreciation for them. Thanks to everyone also who's listening on any of the podcast channels. We are on all of them, but, you know, to name but a few, Apple, Spotify, Google, and Amazon Music. So if you are listening after the fact on demand, thank you very much. Also to mention that if you're listening on the Health Tech Hour channel, thank you. But you can also find us and all the other UK Health Radio shows on the UK Health Radio channels, on all of the podcast channels. So welcome to everyone. Thank you very much for being here. The other thing I'd like to say for those of you that can't hear it, I'm actually quite a little bit under the weather today, but I didn't want to cancel the show. You know, the show must go on. But I will apologize in advance if I sneeze or cough or, you know, splutter. So hopefully everyone can forgive me for that, because it's the time of year for these type of things. So on to today's show. On today's show, we come back to the issue of mental health. And we are joined by Sean Ruan, who's the CEO and founder of Mind Data, based in Cambridge, like PocDoc, Mind Data aims to revolutionize therapy by providing real-time intelligence on mental health trends. So Sean, welcome to the show. How are you?
Good afternoon, Steve. I'm very well. Thank you so much for asking. Yeah, thank you for the invite. It's great to be here.
Great, perfect. Are you based in Cambridge?
Like, do you know us? What? Just outside of Cambridge, Steve, actually. I always say Cambridge because most people know where that is. I'm about 40 minutes northwest, tiny little place called Stamford.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Well, yeah. Cambridge is probably a little bit more familiar to people. So we on the show, we generally go through a few things. One of them is kind of your journey to where you are. I really want to dig into, you know, why you decided to focus on mental health, particularly. You know, there's lots of people working on in that space. And so what the kind of angle or what you felt was not being catered for, I think would be really interesting. And then some just broader discussion around the challenges in accessing mental health services, which we know are getting harder from the NHS. We also know that corporates and employers are looking at it. And, you know, a lot of them, if not the majority of the big ones, have some kind of solution in place. So it'd be interesting to understand what your thoughts are on that. And, you know, is it going to get better? Is it going to get worse? All those type of things. But why don't we start, first of all, with just a bit of background about what Mind Data is and how you came to start the company?
Yeah, with pleasure, Steve. So Mind Data is, as you very kindly said in the introduction, we're a technology that provides real-time insights into mental health trends. And our primary goal is to help shift mental health support from a reactive model to a fundamental proactive approach to mental health. That's our mission as a company. And my journey with mental health actually started back in 2015. My middle brother, Lee, he lost his girlfriend in 2014, right at the end. She had a stage 4 glioblastoma. She passed away, she was 20, bless her heart. And I did the classic manly thing, in inverted commas, of being strong and silent. silent for my brother, and thought that was the right approach. And as is true with most things that we internalize, they will find their way to the surface in one way or another. Mine manifested itself in April 2015, and I became suicidally depressed, and I was had deep suicidal ideation, and I really, really struggled during that time. And out of that experience, we can go into a bit more detail, but out of that experience, I chose to have a life's goal of improving the mental health of 1 million people around the world, primarily just to ensure that I had a purpose that was greater than my circumstances. So that kind of acts as a little bit of an introduction as to where my journey as Sean, started with mental health.
And what, that obviously, thank you very much for sharing. And I think it's pretty consistent. One of the things that's consistent across a lot of health tech founders, but it seems to be particularly in mental health, based on my own experience and the experience of people coming on the show, is they tend to have a very strong personal so what, drive, but it's very personal. So thank you very much for sharing that. What is it at that time? Obviously, because there are lots of people, unfortunately, that end up in a similar position to you, and not all of them come up with this idea of helping a million people. And so what was that process like for you? Was it structured? Did you have someone guiding you through it? Did you just have to figure it out yourself? What was that like?
Well, during that experience, I actually had an amazing counsellor at university called Betty, and she was working with me and improving my mental health. I spent 18 months with her, actually. So I had some structured support around my own recovery. But where the mission, the purpose came from, I really wish I could find this video, but it was... I remember watching an interview with an ex-US soldier that had done a couple of tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, and he was talking about his experiences with severe depression, and had planned his suicide actually in Iraq, I think. And it was him where he said, "I've now realized that my purpose in life should always be greater than any circumstances that I go through." And that was really, sound a bit cliche, that was a real light bulb moment where I thought, I think I need that. No one's ever spoken to me on that level in my life. Gandhi has a purpose, not me. And yet that really kind of landed with me. And I thought, yeah, that's something that I can take from this really negative experience. I think I might be able to just find a way of turning it around like this guy did. So that's actually where it came from, as an accidental YouTube video or interview, whatever it was, that sparked that idea in me.
So was that phrase the this person, he said, I should have a purpose that's greater than any external circumstance I go through? Is that
exactly
the kind of the quote?
It was, yeah, I'm paraphrasing. It was something along those lines. It was the essence of it very much was his purpose should be greater than circumstances. And I remember writing it on my whiteboard in my little dorm room like it was yesterday. It was just something that really clicked in my own mind.
It's funny, isn't it, how stuff can like cut through like that, right? Like, because I don't know, maybe you didn't, but I'm guessing it's possible that you've read lots of articles and been through lots of courses and had lots of support that's considered to be sort of the right way to do things, and then suddenly that quote is the thing that cuts through.
Yeah, I totally agree. It's funny how that works and that lands. And who knows, maybe I'd have seen that video 1 week later perhaps and it wouldn't have landed. So many micro things that happen, and those little domino effects. But you're absolutely right. With all of the counseling that I had, with all of the kind of motivational videos on Instagram, the quotes that were all around there that I was kind of really kind of looking into, it was that one random moment that I watched. So it's funny how that works. You just never know, I guess, where your quotes are.
I mean, I had something similar with a video that I ended up landing on it's the Admiral McRaven Navy SEALs acceptance speech. It's got like a gajillion views. I mean, it's, one of those things. And there's a bit in it where he talks about all you need to do in order to be a Navy SEAL is not ring the bell, as in don't quit, And it's sort of this idea of ringing the bell. And I think he has a phrase like, if you want to change anything in the world, just don't ring the bell. That was the thing that got me. So I completely understand how that can kind of cut through. But so what was the, that was the kind of potentially sort of the clarity moment, but that's still quite a long way away from beginning a company. I mean, you could have gone in lots of different directions.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're absolutely right. And actually, for 5 years, I did go in a different direction after graduating. I was on the early team of an HR technology company called ClearReview. And whilst I kind of kept my passion for mental health on my own Instagram or, you know, LinkedIn, maybe with team meetings as we scaled, you know, I was always a big fan of shouting about mental health. And even if it was just someone saying, look, I'm not listening to what this guy's saying, but it's a man, he's talking about mental health. That's a good thing generally. So yeah. For a while, I kind of put it on a bit of the back burner where I focused on helping build and scale ClearReview, actually. And I did think maybe I can be a TEDx speaker or maybe I'd write a book. Very quickly, I realized I didn't really have a good enough story to be a TEDx speaker. So I kind of like put that.
Yeah,
to
that, I mean, that, it's funny, isn't it? Weird, like TED is really gone, but now TEDx. But even then, it's very hard to get on TEDx.
Extremely hard. Yeah. And well, I think even possibly now, you know, maybe if one day I exit Mind Data, then maybe there'll be something there. Yeah. But certainly at the time, it was something that I kind of let go. And I remember writing the first page of a book called Recondition. That was the name of it, pretentious, but that's what I was going to call it. And I wrote on the first page for Betty, because unfortunately, Betty has since passed away, bless her. So oh, she never got to see Mind Data, which is genuinely heartbreaking because she saved my life. But I didn't get past the first page. I realized I'm probably not an author. So I parked that for a while. And then it was only really after we exited ClearReview about 2 years ago that I really started to think, okay, let's seriously think about how I can use my technology experience now, scaling a company, and really kind of marry that life goal of a million lives with my second love of startups and technology.
Okay, well, that's a great kind of a great place to jump in a bit. So what was the insight? What did ClearReview do, by the way?
Yeah, it was a performance development. So we focused on helping companies move from an annual appraisal approach to employee development to an ongoing approach. So regular check-ins, in the moment feedback, and agile goal setting and agile objectives. And so it was that web-based platform that supported that shift.
And you got an exit.
We did. Yeah, we were acquired in 2020, at the end of 2020, to a company called Advanced. I stayed on for a year as a director of customer success and did my small part in helping transition the team to Advanced whilst I built the first version of Mind Data in the evenings and weekends. But it was a hell of a journey. It was lovely. It was a cool chapter that I went through.
Congrats. So what's the kind of premise behind Mind Data and why is it different to other things in the space, of which hopefully you can admit that there is quite a bit in the space?
Yeah, I totally agree. So I guess I'll just rewind. Of one of the first tenets, I guess, I built Mind Data on was I wasn't going to go down a road where at the time, 2 years ago, I saw a lot of startups kind of having this counselor in your pocket approach, chatbots. I saw a lot of that bubbling up in 2021 or so. And I quickly realized, purely because of my experience with Betty, I truly didn't believe that technology could replace the human intervention of a mental health company. And so that was the first tenet that I built Mind Data on. Whatever I build from a technology perspective, its primary goal will to always be to support and enhance human-to-human support in whatever context that looks like. So I guess that was initially a little bit of one of those differentiators that I built. That was kind of one of those early seeds. And
so did you feel like some of the growth, if for want of a better word, in the mental health services sector was almost trying to remove humans rather than, you know, because there is a lack of mental health professionals, right? Like there's a lack of humans. So did you feel that they were trying to digitize it because there was such a lack of humans and maybe not doing such a good job?
Well, to be fair, actually, I don't think I'm qualified to necessarily whether they're doing a good job or not. Actually, that wasn't the primary focus. I think that they still have and they were serving that need of, you know, the demand was outstripping the supply. I think they genuinely have their place. It was purely from a subjective experience perspective that I just thought that's not where my mental health journey and my experience came from. So I chose to go right instead of left. Not for any negative motivation, really. It was just I saw the experience that I had with Betty and I thought, how could I have made that experience better? And there were a couple of those initial areas of human therapy, human-led therapy, that I thought, I wish I could have improved those. So that's where it started to draw down to what I wanted to build.
Very, very diplomatic response as well.
Yeah, thank you.
So what were those couple of aspects with Betty that you felt like could have been improved?
Yeah, well, the first one was, you know, most therapy sessions, you know, I've been in therapy for 7 years or so on and off, and every session always starts with, Steve, Sean, good to see you. How have you been? What's been going on? That's a very, you know, fair question. And, you know, with a sober mind, I can answer that quite fairly. When I was suicidal and depressed, it was the hardest question in the world to be able to articulate, round up a week's worth of emotions and thoughts. And I suffered from recency bias. So most of the time we would pick up something that purely happened in the last 48 hours between Betty and I, not necessarily the most important thing. And I know that was the case because most times, 24 hours after the therapy session, I would be making a coffee and something would pop into my mind. And I'd think, I really wanted to speak to Betty about that. So I inherently knew that I wasn't picking up the most important things. So objective number one was, how can I remove that reliance on recency bias and reliance on just memory to update Betty in that moment when we had a precious 50 minutes.
Do you think, because I've had a similar experience in my experience of therapy of that particular issue, which is, I don't know whether it's just an English thing or whether it's a human thing, right? But like, if someone asks, oh, how are you getting on? You say, I'm fine. You know, it's like that. It's just that, it's almost like an automatic, yeah, I'm okay. You know, and then it kind of, it takes a while for that person to try and tease out of you. And it depends on how good that person is at teasing things out of you.
Yeah, I totally agree. Absolutely. And I kind of informally referred to it as slight difference between therapeutic conversation and a therapy conversation. I found that, you know, oftentimes I bumble my way through, you know, 10 minutes or so trying to tease something out. And I found it therapeutic. It wasn't a waste of time, but it wasn't therapy. And I think that if therapy wasn't, you know, on a very strict time limit, I probably wouldn't have minded. If I could have run for 90 minutes, 2 hours, it probably wouldn't have stuck in my mind. But you know, goodness knows that at, you know, 1:50, Betty would be wrapping this up and I'd be out of the door. So that really put the emphasis on what a wasted, quote unquote, 10 minutes I had.
Right. Okay. That was the one thing. And what was the second? So recency bias was one thing. You said there was a second. Was that wrapped up with the first?
Yeah. So recency bias was the first thing. And secondly, was actually piggybacking off my experience with ClearReview. Looking at the way management conversations between managers and team members would go, talking about ongoing progression towards employee development, it was all about two people turning up prepared. And that was in direct contrast to my experience with therapy. My therapist, you know, whoever they were amazing at what they did, but goodness knows they weren't prepared for what I'd been through during that week.
Right.
So I thought, I really want to be able to improve that.
Why weren't they, hold on, why weren't they? Is that because Betty wasn't necessarily trained for what the issues that you had? Is that what you mean by that sort of thing?
No, that's a fair question, Steve. No, it wasn't actually about that. It was more, she had no idea what I'd been through. So she was coming into the conversation cold, effectively.
Right. So she needed an update before she could actually deliver the therapy, which uses up precious therapy time.
It does. And that updating procedure for me for 10 minutes was really inefficient. So it's kind of this spiral thing that didn't make sense for me.
No,
so
I can relate to that.
Yeah, they were the two issues that I thought, whatever technology that I build, I want to be able to address those two issues and make those two humans have a better therapy conversation, fundamentally. And that was where my seed really
and
started.
Did you go through a process of validating it with others? Or did you just think, do you know what, if this is me, then it's probably the same for others?
And no, I did speak to people that had been through therapy and were in therapy. Thankfully, as someone that was quite open on Instagram and with my, I could open up to people and they would give me honest feedback. And very quickly, it was a common thing where most people I spoke to said, God, I've never thought about it. But yeah, I have the same experience, actually.
Right.
So quickly, that validated the patient-student experience. And I knew this was a problem that wasn't just within me.
Okay. Well, we are going to stop for a commercial break now, but we'll be back in 2 minutes. And I want to understand how you transitioned, because I think this is one of the most interesting ideas about building a business, particularly a health tech business, which is how do you actually translate an insight into a product or a service that people want, basically, which I think is there are lots and lots of problems in healthcare, lots. But then being able to look at them and then turn that into a product that's scalable, I think is really, really difficult. So let's dig into that after this commercial break. We will be back in 2 minutes with my guest, Sean Ruan, who is the CEO and co-founder of Mind Data.
The station that makes you feel good. UK Health Radio. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour with me, your host, Steve Roost, CEO and co-founder of PocDoc. And this week I'm talking to Sean Ruan, who is the CEO and founder of Mind Data, a Cambridge-based business that is revolutionizing the way that therapy takes place through the use of real-time intelligence of mental health trends. For those of you that have just joined in, I am also suffering from a horrendous cold. So apologies for sniffing and maybe some sneezing. But as I said at the top of the show must go on. And what a show. So let's jump back straight into it. So before we broke, you said that Mind Data came out of your personal experiences around a recency bias in therapy, where you would go in and have to, in effect, sort of spend 10 to 15 minutes updating the therapist and potentially not being able to actually unearth the real issues because you had a tendency to just speak about recent issues. And then, you know, this issue around therapy versus therapeutic, and the fact that the therapist, in your instance, a lady called Betty, had to spend, you know, her own 10 or 15 minutes getting refamiliarized with your issues before she could start to work with you. So how did you take those insights and turn them into a business?
Yeah. So the first port of call was to develop an MVP. So for those uninitiated listening, MVP is a minimal viable product. So it's basically what's the quickest and easiest way I can create something to put in the hands of my desired target market to prove the concept or indeed disprove it. So that was actually mission number one. So in the background, I had stayed on at the acquiring company and they were very supportive. I was very open with them to talk about my long-term plans. And so I stayed on for 4 days a week. That enabled me 3 days a week and evenings to build this minimum viable product. So I used a platform called Bubble and built this very simple to use digital journal that enabled me to track my thoughts and experiences during the week. And then a very basic portal that enabled a therapist to log in and see those. So as part of the prep for both of us, I could see my my experiences over the week to come in prepared. And my therapist can spend 30 seconds after looking at their notes. They can also have a snapshot of my week as well. So we can come in and they can say, Sean, good to see you. How have you been? I know you've had a challenging week. Thursday was hard. We can start there if you want, but patient-led, you can pick up wherever you would like there. So that was the first step of building.
And so did you always build it knowing it would have to be a sort of a two-sided product? So in order for it to be used properly, you would need a patient to enter in some information and for a clinician therapist to review it in order to solve this overall issue.
Yeah, exactly, Steve. You're absolutely right. Yeah, there are plenty at the time, still are. There are plenty of self-journaling platforms out there. And so it couldn't have just been a standalone journal. The beauty, if you will, was that relationship underpinning between the two. So you're absolutely right. It was always a double-edged sword. It was both stakeholders having access to these insights, really important.
And like, how much pushback did you get from therapists on it? Like, I don't know, because I could see in one part of my brain, I'm thinking, well, that makes so much sense. And the other part of my brain is thinking, ooh, they might not want to do anything different than what they've done before.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this kind of ties into this classic startup journey. So I was very fortunate, actually, that the first therapist that I gave it to were naturally forward thinkers, innovative minds, right, that they're really up for trying new things. However, to get scale, you don't need to focus on the early adopters, right? You need the early majority. And I actually found that as we started to progress down this journey, the vast majority of therapists weren't actually interested in changing the way they did things. I think they understood the concept. They could theoretically understand the value, but I guess it was an approach of if it ain't broke, don't fix it. There are, you know, many reasons why this may not be the most efficient way of doing it. And so alongside that, I built MindData on a hypothesis. This will be used for self-employed therapists and their patients. However, until you get out there and prove it, you don't know if that's true. So at the same time, I was putting this technology in the hands of sports teams, universities, organizations to understand where the technology would have had the greatest impact. And as it transpired, actually, it wasn't going to be in the self-employed therapy community.
Okay. And where would it be best used, or where is it being best used?
Yeah. So one of the aspects that became quite apparent relatively early on was within universities. So the concept stays the same, right? You know, a student uses their digital journal to track their experiences. A member of the welfare team has access to these insights. But talking to leaders within mental health and well-being at more of an organizational approach, one thing that really came to the fore was this idea of mental health support within an organization being, quote unquote, a little bit fluffy. That term came out quite a lot.
Yeah.
Generally lacked meaningful data or strategies with mental health, generally weren't being underpinned by quantitative measurable insights or data as a whole.
Yeah.
So that started to spark a bit of a sea to say, well, how can we work with you to improve that? So that's where this latest feature that we've built comes into play. And we've created a dashboard that goes on top of all of this, where it enables leaders or managers, non-wellbeing professionals, to have live aggregated anonymized insights to cohorts of people and their mental health trends to underpin strategies and help them shift towards proactive.
And how much of an issue is mental? So this is within student, this is within universities, correct?
Yeah,
or is this different institutions?
Yeah.
So
yeah.
How much has how has the problem changed, gotten better, gotten worse at universities around mental health over the last sort of 10 or 20 years? What does the trend data say?
Generally speaking, we've seen that mental health for students has over time decreased in terms of the data. Now, there is obviously a couple of schools of thought of that. Is mental health genuinely getting worse? Or is it simply that as a culture, we're becoming more open about it? So
yeah.
People are more comfortable seeking the help, asking for it, recording on student engagement surveys. So all we're seeing is that the attention or the need for mental health is increasing, regardless of the underlying factors. What that's causing is an extra strain on generally under-resourced student mental health teams. And sorry, Steve, yeah.
Go on.
Yeah, sorry, yeah. So what we're seeing is that because more students are looking for this support, universities are looking at more holistic ways of saying, well, how can we help students improve their mental health? It may not always be hiring yet another therapist on site, for example. How do we get upstream and start to become more preventative instead of purely reactive?
What data do you have that could explain to, you know, me and the listeners, like, how big of an issue is mental health at universities? X% of students say they have problems, or how do they track it? Like, do they not track it, really? They don't know.
Well, I think there are two main aspects from our experience where universities are tracking kind of mental health. Number one is the uptake of or the requirement of support within universities. And the second is with student engagement surveys. They're the top two areas. I mean, the biggest challenge with student engagement surveys, certainly from my experience, was that they kind of provide lagging data ever so slightly.
Yeah.
Because we do it termly or biannually, and so it's a bit of a look back. You know, we realized that back in February we had this issue, for example, and so they're fundamentally, I mean, they're not the only ways that mental health data is tracked within universities, but for sure that's the lion's share within universities of how they understand the requirements of student needs when it comes to mental health. And so that's where we want to come in and start to support them to say, you know, are your initiatives working? Which subcategories of students need, you know, more support, for example?
Right.
It's traditionally quite, if you will, kind of a spray and pray approach. You know, we provide a resource and it's for everybody.
Okay. Yeah, they'll put a therapist in there or a student welfare counselor, and whoever books up the places.
You're absolutely right. Yeah, exactly. And that's putting a lot of strain on mental health professionals within universities, and of course the universities themselves as well, trying to find the resources and where to put their investment.
And also justify the expense. I hate to say it, but they have to work out a way to track it, because if you can't track it, then you can't show it's getting better, and therefore you can't, you can't justify the ongoing expense potentially.
You're absolutely right. And I think that if there, many things that have come out of the pandemic, it is this kind of more awareness around mental health in general, in whatever the flavor it is. And I think that if organizations are going to continue to invest into mental health support resources or whatever it looks like, there will obviously be a requirement of more data moving forward to measure the effectiveness, measure the return on investment, understand where to put those, investments as well. It's going to be really important moving forward.
So how, if someone's doing self-journaling, right?
Yep.
And this might be really easy to explain because it's just how the app works. But a lot of that might be like free text. And so then how do you pull aggregated data from lots of free text to draw out those trends?
Yeah, very, very fair question, and hopefully fairly simple to answer. So when we offer the journal element of our platform, there are two areas at which you can record a thought. Number one is a subjective 0 to 10 scale. Subjectively, Steve, how are you feeling right now? There's no objective measure of what 10 is. It's different between you and I, but all we need to know is that you feel 9 out of 10 right now. You can add then, you don't have to, but if you want to, add a few thoughts, words, sentences about why you're feeling that, what you're going through. So they're the two main areas that we capture. And what we can do is very simple. There are a lot of clever artificial intelligence companies out there doing very cool things. We've adopted an iterative approach of keep it very simple, basically. So we do quantitative analysis on the subjective mood scores over time, and we analyze those journal entries and derive themes. So what type of theme is Steve recording when it comes
to...
So
you could do a search for how many times the phrase difficult is mentioned or something.
In essence, you're absolutely right. What we do is we take those broad categories and then we roll them up so that the decision makers, the leaders of welfare, can see which themes are becoming more prominent within certain categories of students.
And is this the first time they've been able to see this type of information, other than those student surveys, which are 6 months and get 6 month lag and requires people to actually fill them out?
Yeah, I think in terms of real-time aggregated data and pulling out themes, we are very much in the, an early phase of being a technology that provides those types of real-time insights. It's in and of itself, as you quite rightly said, it's not a new type of data that someone can get, but it is in terms of real-time data rather than this periodic survey. Inherently, if you're only relying on surveys, there is only a certain amount of proactiveness that you can do. And so we want to shift that to say, what do we need to do moving forward before this gets worse for a particular demographic of student?
And what kind of feedback have you had from students or users or clinicians or universities or anyone else?
Yeah, we're having really good feedback so far. So let's start with the challenges, actually, because to keep it fair, one of the biggest challenges that we're facing is change management. So we know that journaling is really important. And even when we go back to the days of paper-based journaling, we know the benefits. But whether you're paper-based journaling or digital journaling, establishing new habits are always really hard. And so what we're doing is trying to take university students on a journey where we set a realistic target. When you think of journaling, you think of every morning and every night. Actually, that's quite an unrealistic bar to set, let's be honest, especially if you're going through mental health challenges. So we say, set a realistic target of 1 30-second check-in a week. That will help take a university from 0 to 1. Suddenly you have weekly data points flowing in. So that's one way that we're helping universities move towards that, by supporting that change management approach that has its roots in a challenge. The other aspect is being able to leverage these real-time insights for different demographics of students. Mm. That's really important because it's that nuance between equality and equity, right? Equality is everybody, regardless of the background, you have access to support. Equity says, well, what type of support does this subcategory of student require? It may be different to other categories. So that's also a big part of what we want to do, of playing a role in the future of student mental health.
And a university is kind of required. I assume there's some kind of requirement for some kind of care, duty of care over a student. There must be something, right?
Well, do you know, this is actually being debated quite a lot at the moment of where an educational provider stands when it comes to mental health, right?
Right.
They have a duty of care not to play a part in declining student mental health, put them at risk. But the question is, when you have a university, your primary goal is to provide education. It's not to provide healthcare support. You're supposed to signpost and support. Now, I think that is actually changing. When we hear about these horrible, heartbreaking stories of students, dying by suicide, for example, there is becoming more of a push of saying, should universities play more of an active role in that? Are you just an educational provider? Maybe not. It's a little bit of a gray area.
Yeah, I don't know. I think it's interesting because you're dealing with adults clearly, right, over 18s. But then employers have a duty of care over their staff, they are required to sort of ensure that the conditions that are present foster good health and, so I certainly don't create, negative working conditions. So I could see that universities have something. I could also see that they might be slightly scared because, if you don't want to accidentally create a situation where people kind of draw the conclusion that exams are stressful. So exams cause people's mental health to decline. Therefore, exams should be banned. It's tricky. I was just saying that I thought that it's an interesting one because I could see that, employers have a duty of care. So why wouldn't a university? But then I could see them being a bit nervous because some of the things that they force you to do create stress. Exams, clearly, people failing exams clearly create stressful situations, negative situations. And I could see somebody somewhere at universities being a bit worried about accidentally backing themselves into a corner on that stuff. But there's got to be a solution.
Well, yeah, I totally agree. And I think that all of those fears are absolutely valid and trying to understand the role that an educational provider plays within an adult's life. But I do think that regardless of, legislation, I think that universities or organisations will be pulled rather than pushed. I think that at some point, students are going to start setting an expectation of what do you proactively do to support our mental health? We're a new generation. We talk about it a lot. We're more open about it. And actually, just having a reactive, well-being team, as fantastic as they are, it may not be enough, for example. So I think that universities will eventually want to pick the best students, right, and compete for them. And I think the mental health and the type of support that they meaningfully provide will start to become more of a big part of decision-making for students.
I could see that generational shift taking place.
Yeah.
Sure. I think it'll be interesting to see how soon it happens and that type of thing. But I completely agree with you. I think it's become much more of an issue. But maybe when you start to look at the data that's being done, maybe exams are going to be up there, but exams happen once a year, basically. I mean, maybe a bit more frequently, depends on the course, So it might not be that that's the biggest stressor, actually.
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think that that's, one of the beauties of using, something like Mind Data. We don't know what we don't know, and having that real nuanced insight just to prove or disprove different hypotheses. And I think that's really important for universities to be able to do that and take a data-driven approach rather than putting the guesswork and say, we assume that exams, well, it could be financial well-being during the month of March, for example.
And so does it work that when you work with the university, the app is available for everybody, or how does the access piece work?
Yeah. So firstly, actually, from a technological perspective, we don't have a downloadable app. We've built it as a web-based platform at the moment. Okay. We're device agnostic. The way that students have access is that we onboard the university as an entity, and then they, as part of onboarding, they then invite their students to use Mind Data. So that's the kind of sign-on process, and that's how we ensure that the right student is tagged to the right university for their aggregated data.
Cool. Okay. So we've reached the end of the second part of the show. We're going to go for our last commercial break, and then we will come right back into this week's Health Tech Hour, where I want to drill into kind of the access to mental health services overall, because it's been an issue that's been really front and center in the news for a really long time now, I feel, and rightly so. So it'd be great to get your views on that, because it's one of these themes that keeps coming up in association with the word crisis, mental health crisis, NHS crisis. And so I don't know if it's just one long crisis or what the, you know, I'd just be interested to get your thoughts on that. But we'll be back in 2 minutes for the last part of this week's show with Sean Moran, the CEO and founder of Mind Data. We'll be right back.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good. The station that makes you feel good.
Hello and welcome back to this week's Health Tech Hour on UK Health Radio. Sorry for the slight delay there. I was blowing my nose. Thank you very much for listening. Apologies again for being slightly under the weather and croaky. But this is the final part of the show with this week's guest, Sean Moran, who is the CEO and founder of Mind Data. So, Sean, one question I have is, and it relates, it might sound like a really silly question, but we're a broad church. So, you know, I like to ask these questions. Why is journaling considered to be so helpful for mental health?
Well, I mean, you know, firstly, I'll preface this by saying I'm just a punk that was depressed and went through some really hard challenges. So I'm certainly not a qualified psychologist, but I can share my experiences and where we stand at Mind Data from that perspective. I think it's the sense of A, being it's a cathartic experience. When you can get something out of your mind and on paper, you can see it for what it is. That was certainly my experience of journaling. There's this kind of weird magnification that happens when you hold things in your mind and they seem to just get bigger and bigger. But by getting them out there and asking yourself certain questions, that journal acts as a bit of a therapist. So you can explain what you're feeling. You prompt yourself to say, well, why am I feeling that? What is it? You know, you articulate your thoughts, you articulate your emotions around it. So that experience is quite cathartic. But also it helps to be able to provide a bit of a look back. I think that when we experience, you know, prolonged mental health journeys, you know, over months or maybe even years, you know, when you zoom in and you're on a bit of a downwards trend for 2 months, it feels like you are constantly on a downward trend. But when you zoom out and you have the ability to look back, you can say, actually, overall, you know, I'm on an upwards trend. So this kind of acts as a little bit of a safety net to get things out of our minds and just get it on paper. Certainly helps me sleep better at night, as weird as that sounds, just to go to bed with a bit of a clearer mind.
Yeah. So I've been doing, I do this thing called the 6-minute diary. You know it? You come across it?
Now, I've heard of it. I've never used it, but I've heard of it. Yeah.
Really good. I can really recommend it to anyone out there as well. It's sort of like a journaling light. It's more gratitude focused, and it's a bit more controlled, and it sort of tells you what you have to write each day, but it's maximum of 5 minutes each day. Great. Unless you want to give it a bit longer. But it's it really works for me. So I can completely agree with some of the stuff that you said there about why it's helpful. But it just journaling does seem to form a pretty big part of mental health practice, I think.
I think you're right. It's a very common aspect of this. I totally agree. And like you said, there are so many different flavors of journaling. I just want to piggyback off what you said. You know, one of the things that I do in the morning is a gratitude list. Some people, you know, think it's quite hippie, but I think it's genuinely really grounding to be able to provide a bit of a step back view to say, hey, you know what? I'm subjectively experiencing these things. But these things are real. I do have things that I'm for. And so, yeah, I just wanted to say, Steve, I'm a big fan of, you know, having a gratitude journal and gratitude list as well. And again, echo what you've said, highly recommend it for anybody going through some mental health challenges out there. Definitely.
Yeah, I think it was, for me, it was the first time I'd really done anything like that. And it was really kind of instructive to remind me in all of the maelstrom of all of the craziness of being a founder and doing all these different things, you know, what I was already grateful for, mm-hmm. what I already had or have in my life that I should be grateful for. And also the appreciation of the small things, you know, like a great cup of coffee or a really nice breakfast or, you know, all of these things, like you say, are objectively really good things. And you know, calling them out to yourself actually can be one of the best parts of the day.
I totally agree. It's such a good start. And like you said, there's no there's no thing too small to be grateful for. I absolutely agree. You know, so many, you know, times during the day, if, you know, I always think of this thing of, you know, Steve, Bob, whoever, would you consider yourself a grateful person? Now, most people would say, absolutely. You know, I'm grateful for many things. Are you grateful for your parents? Absolutely. Now, here's the kicker. When was the last time you were consciously grateful? When did you reach out to your mum and say, do you know what? I'm really grateful for having you in my life, mum, or whatever it may be. And I think that's where a lot of people then fall off and say, God, I don't think I ever have been, you know, and there's more time thinking about, you know, the bill that's coming up, or, you know, the, you know, economic climate, whatever it may be, rather than just spending some time. So, I love that, Steve. Yeah. So
one of the questions you have to fill out every day in the 6-minute journal is, what is the good thing I did today?
Great.
And when they coach you through it at the beginning, they're like, the purpose of that question is twofold. One is that you probably did something good today or nice today that you didn't realize that you did. And you reminding yourself that you did that is really positive for your own mental well-being. And secondly, by consciously calling that out, you're more likely to do nice things, you know, to other people.
Yeah. And just on that note, Steve, I just wanted to just in kind of 30 seconds, just turn the table just really quickly, please. Because as a busy founder and CEO, you'll know exactly what it's like that most of our days are filled with problems and solving problems. So it can be really hard to take the time to recognize the journey you've been on. My question is, do you use that in the context of your business as well to pause and reflect about what a good thing you've done today for the company?
So my I guess the way I do it, and to be fair, so I did it religiously. Well, religiously sounds a bit of a silly use of the word. I did it every single day as soon as I got the journal from sort of last Christmas all the way through last year. Then things got a little hectic and I stopped it, but now I've sort of started it back up again. This year's been a bit stop start, I guess. But I take it holistically across my whole life. So I don't differentiate between this thing was good over there, but that happened at work. So I take the whole, you know, the whole thing. So, you know, if I was nice to someone at work or nice to someone in a work context or did something positive at work, then that would go in. But similarly, the same family or personal, I don't differentiate, just purely because I don't feel like those differentiations are valid for me at the moment. You know, the life of a founder, well, everyone, lots of people work hard. So that's the wrong thing to say. But I think that it's hard to leave the job at the door at 5 o'clock in the evening. Yeah. You know, if it's your company, and it's certainly hard to, you know, not start till 9 in the morning. So that, you know, it does overflow into the rest of your life. You know, my co-founder is my wife as well. One of my co-founders is my wife. So, you know, that's another layer of these sort of traditional boundaries between job and home life are completely blurred for us. So that's why I throw it all in together.
That's wonderful. Have you ever heard of the Wheel of Life, Steve? Have you ever?
No.
Use that. So that's actually a really nice opportunity to kind of give a bit of an audit, and I do it, you know, once a year or so. Effectively, the Wheel of Life is imagine like a pizza, and it's made up of, I can't remember the number, I think it's between 9 and 12 little slices, if you will, and each slice represents a different sector of our lives, whether it's physical fitness, career progression, finances, ... and then from the center going outwards on each pizza slice is a scale from 0 to 10, and you just shade in on each of these, and you can visual representation of where your current audit of your life is, and you can quickly identify where you're lagging behind. And so I just wanted to say that, because that brings into this holistic approach that you're talking about, that actually the whole thing is interconnected. It's not about feeling good at home and not feeling good at work. They are intrinsically connected, especially if you're a founder, of course, but for most hardworking people. And, you know, if you don't have the time to necessarily journal, having yourself a bit of an audit using if you Google like the Wheel of Life, you'll be able to have a printable download. That's quite helpful, actually, I find.
Yeah, they have a similar thing in here. Every kind of like, you know, month or so, you're supposed to do like a checklist across all these different kind of factors.
Okay.
But yeah, no, I agree. I think just any kind of reflection is good. But it's hard to, I found it didn't come necessarily naturally to me. So I had to sort of find a format that I could follow to force myself to do it. And so it doesn't come naturally, I don't think, to lots of people, but it is really valuable.
I totally agree. And I think, you know, the hardest thing with deriving the value from this approach of journaling or auditing, whatever it looks like, is the consistency. And, you know, goodness knows that's one of the hardest things that I find, is consistently doing something. The one thing that I would say is, as long as you are consistently doing something, that's really beneficial. If you go for a period of 3 months and you're only doing a gratitude list and you're not journaling, great. Own that, you know. And that's the one thing that in my early days of, you know, kind of post-suicidal depression, I used to beat myself up quite a lot to say, why am I not doing a certain thing every day? And then shift that focus to, as long as I'm doing something every day, I recognize that, like, the seasons that will fluctuate.
Do you think that there's a bit of, so on the socials, Instagram probably mostly, I would say, there's a lot of talk from various people around journaling and gratitude and these different things. Obviously, talking about those things, is there's a net positive impact about talking about them because you raise awareness of them. But a little bit like you just said there, do you think it creates the impression in some people that they're failing because they're not doing it every day, and they see it from these people claiming that they do it every day? And, you know, like, my morning routine, I get up at 6 o'clock in the morning and I pray for half an hour, and then I have half an hour of self-reflection, then I do my journaling, then I, you know, and then I get breakfast for my three kids and get them to school and things like that. I'm thinking, well, like, my day starts at 6 a.m. when my three kids get up and start tearing the house to pieces. So, you know, I'm not really in a kind of self-reflective mood at that point.
I could not agree more with that sentiment of, you know, what's that saying of, don't compare your life to someone else's highlight reel. And I think the social media is simply a highlight reel. It is not indicative of real life whatsoever. And I think if you can follow people on Instagram or LinkedIn that prioritize vulnerability over the perfect reflection of something, that's genuinely better, because nobody does that. And I think that, to your question, I actually do think it drives lower mental health overall, because you do feel guilty for looking at what you should be doing, quote unquote.
Yeah, I actually, weirdly, I'm starting to think that LinkedIn is becoming a bit more supportive about that, because I feel like the stuff that you see there is very focused, I think, on a people achieving, I would say, work type goals, right? So, and it's by verified people, in effect, that have jobs, for want of a better word. Then they're not just people being famous for being famous, sort of thing. And it's quite sort of, I don't know, not overtly soft and fluffy, but weirdly sort of advice led, a bit like, this worked for me, maybe this will work for you, type of thing.
Yeah, I definitely see that shift happening, no question. And over the last, you know, couple of years, I've also seen that vulnerability introduced. I think that, you know, initially a lot of things that were shared on LinkedIn were positioning people as to, effectively, why am I the best? You know, this is how it is. Now we're seeing actually vulnerability be rewarded with followers, with people buying into genuine mission-led, honest companies that are led by honest, vulnerable leaders and founders. And so, all that to be said, Steve, I totally agree. I think that we're seeing more healthy posts happening on LinkedIn, but I still think there is definitely an element of a highlight reel. I think that a lot of people that do share advice are still coming from a place of, here's why I'm great, here's why what I've done is a success, and what you should do next. I would definitely welcome more people to say, hey everyone, I've messed up here, I've not done a very good job. You know, I would welcome that more and more.
Makes sense. Well, Sean, what a conversation. That was brilliant. We've come to the end of the show. I really appreciated the openness and the honesty. And thank you very much for coming on. If people want to learn more about Mind Data, where do they go?
Thank you, Steve. Yeah, thank you so much for the invite. You can head over to minddata.io, minddata.io, or you can find me on LinkedIn. My name, Sean Ruane. So that's where I post a lot of our updates.
Brilliant. Sean, thank you very much for coming on the show. And thank you, everyone, for listening. We'll be back again next week. Thank you.
Thank you.